You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about being prepared for the next outbreak of who knows what. It could be the flu, could be bioterrorism attack, could be some other kind of disease, could be food poisoning. With my guests, Maren McKenna, beating back the devil on the front lines with the disease detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, just out by Free Press. Shelley Hearn, executive director of the nonprofit group Trust for America's Health. And Arnold Amanto, he is professor of epidemiology and director of the Bioterrorism Preparative Initiative, University of Michigan. Dr. Amanto, how prepared do you think we are for a bioterrorism attack?
Well, I think we're a lot better prepared than we were a couple of years ago when the anthrax outbreaks hit. I think this really has happened as well at the local level. We've heard about what's happening at CDC, and indeed they do all have BlackBerries now because we keep getting, we can contact our colleagues at the CDC most anytime, and they do respond. But at the local level, as you just heard, many of the county health departments had no computers. They really were untrained to handle not only a bioterrorist incident, but any kind of an outbreak, because public health had been totally neglected. I think we're moving in the right direction, but again, we have to watch out because funding is being reexamined and may get cut in the future. We have to realize that absent a bioterrorist episode, we are going to have challenges to our health care system, and the state health departments and especially the local health departments in the counties, et cetera, need to be part of the system. That's where everything really is put into effect, and we really have to keep them at the same level as the feds.
You know, when I talk to health care workers at hospitals, people who work in hospitals, they say, money? What money? We didn't get any money for bioterrorism preparedness. We can't even keep the clinic open for, you know, for emergency rooms. What kind of money are you talking about? Do you find that to be the case, Shelley Hearn?
Well, we've actually done the analysis looking at just as the federal money came in to help fix those gaps in preparedness, majority of states actually cut their budgets to the state health departments, so that just at the very time when we were supposed to be shoring up and strengthening those frontline health defenses, we actually had the states undercutting them. So we were asking those, our best and brightest, whether they're EIS officers or the state health officers, to be doing more today with actually less money. And that's part of the problem.
So how can you be prepared if the really frontline people who are going to see the first epidemic come in and be exposed to whatever, you know, kind of bugs that might be coming in, you know, in terms of disease, how can we expect them to be ready if they're not, they don't have the funding? And Dr. Amanto says, it's changing, but is it more talk than action, Dr. Amanto?
Well, I think there has been action. I don't think there's been enough action. And I think it really has to be generalized throughout the system. Emergency responders need to be ready. The emergency rooms need to be ready. And I think at our larger hospitals, things have changed. But we have a long way to go because the public health infrastructure was neglected for so many years. We really are starting at below ground level, and we have to move ahead.
1-800-989-8255. Donald in the Dalles, Oregon. Hi, Donald.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a couple of comments. I worked 30 years in public health, 26 of them with the Centers for Disease Control, and I'm retired now. And I had a lot of experience between 1968 and when I finally retired in 2001 with the state of Nevada. And I just wanted to share a few insights. I was fortunate enough to work in communicable disease control and prevention, and we were never adequately funded until later during the HIV and AIDS epidemic. We did start getting funding. And I was fortunate enough also to be on one of the first epidemiologic teams to investigate this new disease that was killing young men in the Bay Area, New York, and Los Angeles. I worked with Dr. Harold Jaffe, who is a assistant surgeon general. I believe he's recently retired, too. And you probably heard about those early days in community disease control.
Right.
What I wanted to mention is that we've never even been able to get a serious handle on traditional communicable diseases such as syphilis, gonorrhea, and other STDs in this country. Dr. Judith Wasserheit from the CDC built up a syphilis eradication program. And as she said, as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, we had 50 to 100 times the STD rate of any of the other 29 industrial democracies. And there's a reason for that. We're not prepared. Public health has always been underfunded and is a stepchild. And in recent years, it's been politicized, so our hands were tied. The politicians say we couldn't use the condom word, and language was restricted in pamphlets, that sort of thing. And there's one reason for this, and only one reason. The United States does not believe in prevention. 90% of our health care dollars are spent in the last weeks or few months of life. It isn't health care, it's death and dying care.
Hmm.
Prevention dollars are a very, very, very small percent of the health care dollars spent in this country.
Well, let me get a comment. Shelley Hearn, you agree?
Well, I absolutely agree. And here's the beauty. Public health is all about preventing disease. If we have an enormous health care crisis in this country, the costs are off the charts. How do you want to fix it? Start investing in preventing diseases. And the point that Donald was making is a very good one. If we build this public health system right, which is what we really need to do, it's the wake-up call we got from bioterrorism and from SARS even the debacle going on with the flu vaccine, it's broken right now. We need to modernize that system. It's not costing huge amounts of dollars, but we just haven't had that type of focus. And if you do it right, you really will be prepared for the full spectrum, whether it's the bioterrorism event today or the chronic disease problems that are everyday health threats. But take a look at Nevada. It's a very good example where Donald's, last worked. That's a state that doesn't actually make investments of its state dollars into its health department. Really, the only money that they have to operate is coming from the federal government. The state itself hasn't stepped up to the plate to take its responsibility to take better protection of its citizens from the everyday epidemics that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the debacle about the flu vaccine, what would you suggest? I mean, how should we change the system?
If I may, one of the first things you have to realize is that this vaccine shortage was absolutely predictable. It probably is just as predictable as the Yankees being in the baseball playoffs. You knew it was coming along.
And we've had it almost every year for the last few years, right?
We sure have. And we have it in several different of our vaccines, particularly children have had enormous shortages in getting the vaccines that they need to make sure that they live long and healthy lives. It's been our most effective tool in battling infectious diseases, but we don't have a national vaccine policy in this country. We've essentially forced industry out of this country. We went from having 30 different vaccine manufacturers down to 3. It was a point made earlier that if you have the production in just a few hands, that you are vulnerable to all types of fiascos, whether it be a plant that has a failure or actually becomes a target of terrorism. That's not how you protect your public. And what we need to do is take a look very smartly at how we make vaccines, once again, our successful and winning tool and against the battle of those infectious bugs out there.
Dr. Manto, what's your take on this?
Well, I disagree a little bit because I don't think we've forced vaccine manufacturers out. I think there are not incentives to produce vaccines because vaccines, from a manufacturer's standpoint, are a little more chancy to produce than drugs. They can always make a lot more money producing another antihypertensive drug or another Viagra as opposed to producing a vaccine. What's different this year from previous years is that in the past we've had delays in influenza vaccine production. This year it's an actual shortage, and we really are very unlikely to be able to make up for the enormous shortfall that we have. And I don't think this was anticipated.
But there has been talk about possibly next year buying in advance like 100 million doses. Would that work?
Right. The vaccine manufacturers, we live in a profit-driven economy. The vaccine manufacturers will produce what they can sell. If they know that they can sell the vaccine, that it won't get unused, because we're dealing here with a seasonal commodity. If it isn't used in the season, if it isn't available at the start of the season, you're in trouble. If it isn't used by the end of the season, then you know that you're not going to get as much the next year.
Why couldn't you have a pool of money from all the drug companies that make drugs? And let's say, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, say, you'll charge an extra penny a pill for every pill that you sell, and that money would go to a central pool that would be divided up among companies to make a vaccine specific. That's the pool of money. So we'd have it locally, we'd have control over it and the quality, and keep it here in the United States, and we wouldn't have to worry about importing it from someplace else. What would be wrong with that?
I think there are many different ways to incentivize vaccine manufacture, and I think you just pointed out one way. In fact, there is a tax put on the childhood vaccines to use in terms of what was really tort reform, because a lot of the costs of supplying children's vaccines were associated with legal claims, and that has been a very good system. You could do the same kind of thing if there's a will to make sure we do have adequate supplies of vaccine.
I think it's just shameful that here you are in the 21st century and 40 million people are not going to get a vaccine that science has made available to them.
Well, and Ira, that's just the very point, is we haven't modernized many of our public health components, whether it's vaccines or making sure that we have enough of those EIS officers ready to go, or the laboratories that can do the work and analyze where the problems are and what's happening. In many respects, we still have a public health system that reflects the problems from the 1800s rather than being positioned to fight the 21st century health threats. And vaccines is a great example, but the idea that you threw out there, that's just the kind of thing that our policymakers need to be doing. We need to have a congressional commission put together that you pull the best and brightest together, you lock them in a room for a few days, and you negotiate how to create a vaccine policy that's going to work for this country. It's more than just creating incentives. It's also making the investment that we have modern technology so that we're not still relying on hen eggs to create a vaccine. There are more modern ways that we could be doing, much more innovative science that we could be bringing to it, but it's an archaic science that hasn't been invented, invested in, and it hasn't been given the push and priority to make it really, again, our number one tool to prevent disease.
We're talking about diseases and what you might get this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phones, get a couple of questions in here if we can. Let's go to Katie in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, Katie?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I tuned in my car, and I think I might have misunderstood. You were talking about the fact that doctors and workers in the CDC are only able to work there for 2 years, and then they have to move, and I wanted to know why that was, and then also how much time is needed for the flu vaccine to be produced, since it isn't it a guess as to what flu is going to hit, and so do they actually have to have some of the flu that's going to hit, and then they produce antibodies for that?
Good questions. Okay, Maren McKenna, can you answer the first one?
Sure. I think that the listener misheard a little bit. People who belong to the Epidemic Intelligence Service can only serve for 2 years for a couple of reasons. First, because it is really a 24/7 job. They are on the go all the time. And secondarily, because it was meant initially, in addition to being a bioterror detection force, to be something that turned people on to the idea of working in public health. When it was founded in the 1950s, there really were very few epidemiologists, disease detective scientists in the country. And the founder of the Epidemic Intelligence Service thought if he brought young doctors to the CDC and gave them 2 years of experience, they'd want to stick with the field afterward. And even if they went back to caring for patients or went onto a medical school faculty, they would always have that point of view of thinking about a potential outbreak in the back of their minds. And that's really critical now, because one of the things that's needed in building back the public health system is not just all the investment down into the fine levels of state and local health departments that Dr. Hearn and Dr. Monto have talked about. It's also necessary to bring the attention of average doctors and nurses and other health professionals into this system, even though they don't, in a technical sense, belong to the system. Let's remember that the very first anthrax case in the anthrax outbreak was discovered just because one smart doctor in Lantana, Florida, thought to test the cerebrospinal fluid of the first victim, Bob Edwards, and saw the anthrax bacillus when he stained the fluid.
Interesting. Okay, Katie, we'll get the second part. Dr. Monto, can you answer the second part about how do you guess what the flu virus is going to be?
Well, every year in February, there is a meeting at both WHO and at FDA in the Washington area. And what we do is examine the occurrence of influenza in the world and anticipate what the viruses are that are going to be going to need to be put in the vaccine. Flu is unique. It keeps changing. We don't have to update other vaccines on a yearly basis. We do have to update flu vaccine. We do pretty well. Most years, we've got the right viruses in the vaccine, and it does require good surveillance to know what's going on out there in the world. What happened last year, if you remember, we had Panama in the vaccine and Fujian was occurring. What happened then was that there was not a very good isolate of Fujian in eggs that could easily be put in the vaccine. Those kinds of problems can be fixed in the future if we have greater investment in surveillance and improved methodology to produce influenza vaccines by different ways. So I think we need to attack the problem on several levels, and new funding will, in fact, hasten our ability to improve the vaccine and have vaccines that 9 years out of 10 may be right, but 1 year out of 10 may not be right.
A quick question before the break. Do we have that new funding?
We don't have that funding yet. We are getting some new funding, and this funding actually is coming in part from the concept that a flu pandemic is very much like a bioterrorist incident, so that the kinds of funding that are available for fighting bioterrorism are also being utilized to control influenza pandemics.
All right, we're going to come back and actually pick up on that pandemic theme and talk about the bird flu that is sort of incubating, I guess, and spreading around in Asia. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.